She's April.
And she's Molly.
And we are
the Book Besties. I have days that I still am like, you know, I could stab him in his sleep and he wouldn't know.
I want you to get to the most problematic character and be like, Daddy?
Your neighbors can hear every scream. Okay, everybody. So as you can see, Molly is not here this week. Molly is having a flare-up, and so she's not here. But I am joined by amazing author Mary E. Roach to talk about her book, We Are the Match. And look at this cover. I mean, I love the pinks. Like, pinks with flames was brilliant. Also, is it pink and orange because that's one of the pride flags?
I mean, yes, it's very like lesbian colors, but it's really just pink because I wanted it to be pink. And they sent me a bunch of mock-ups and I was like, here's a mock-up I made that's pink. And they were like, actually, we'll use it. So I got really lucky.
You made this? This is incredible.
I made like a really silly looking mock-up that was pink. And then their designers made it look pretty. So like, I can't take full credit for that, but I can take credit for the pinkness of it.
I love it. Pink is my favorite color, and this particular pink is my favorite, so I was really excited. But this is an advanced reader copy because your book does not come out until July 29th, right? Is that correct?
Yes.
All right, perfect. So thank you, Mary, for the ARC. Thank you to Montlink for the ARC. We were very excited. So we were reached out to by essentially, I guess, PR team. Would that be the right term for it? And we've gotten a few authors that way this season in particular. Mm-hmm. And I read the synopsis of your book and I was like, I'm sold. First of all, I'm a former English teacher. So the literary basis of the book, I was like in. And we say this a lot on this podcast. Molly is queer and I am an ally. So we love doing queer books. And this year we did some throughout the year, but we also always have Pride Month. But I will say, next season, guys, for the fans, so you know, we're going to put our money where our mouth is, and we're not going to just stick queer books in Pride Month because queer books matter all year round. So you've been told. So we're very, very excited to have you. I'm ready to get into it. Is it okay if I do your bio? I know. Is it okay if I do your bio?
Yeah, go for it. Thank you.
Okay. Mary E. Roach is an author of thrillers and mysteries and a fan of all things spooky, which is right up Molly's alley. But ask about true crime podcasts at your own risk. There are hot takes. Good to know. When Mary is not writing stories for and about powerful girls, she can be found teaching martial arts, baking an unreasonable amount of cookies, or taking off on through hikes through the wilderness or northern Minnesota. Cannot talk today, which is pretty awesome. I am not an outdoor girl. I am an indoor April, but I will eat the cookies.
Yeah, I can provide those. It's an expertise of mine. Yeah.
Awesome. So, so I was wondering if you would be so kind as to share with our listeners a synopsis for your book, We Are the Match.
Yeah. Yes. So We Are the Match is, I have been pitching it as like a sapphic reimagining of the myth of Helen of Troy, but in a modern setting in crime families in modern day Greece. It's a fictional island. So the actual similarities to like modern day Greece is obviously we stretch it a little bit because we have these like crime families. Helen is the daughter of a crime lord. She is set to inherit the empire and she also has an arranged marriage that she would do anything to get out of. And she herself is planning to fake her death and leave all of this behind. And then enter Paris, who is a really low-level fixer within the crime families who has a grudge against Helen's family for the loss of her sisters, her foster sisters when she was a teenager. So she is here to kill Helen. And I don't know any better start to a romance than wanting to unalive each other. So
right.
Paris best kind choice. Of appropriates Helen's party. And then instead of fulfilling her little vengeance quest, she saves Helen's life. And Helen is like, okay, well, we should work together to figure out who bombed my party and who's after me. And Paris is sort of like, well, girly pop, I'm after you. But, you know, I can't say that out loud. so they enter into this like shenanigans together where they pretend that they are like maybe having a little affair. Helen's getting something out of her system before she enters this arranged marriage, as they are going undercover looking for answers about who else is attempting to get some revenge on Helen's family, or is making a move against their family's power. And then as they start to get deeper into the world of the crime families together, they start to realize they might have some more complicated feelings than just vengeance or escape.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's my like really rough synopsis. I feel like everyone else is better at pitching this book than I am. And it was easier to write like 70,000 words than it was to like condense it down into something pitchable.
Well, I mean, the idea of Helen of Troy modern retelling with crime families, that right there was what sold me on this book. I was like, yes, I'm in. And, you know, we love sapphic books here. We love love of all kinds. I'm a romance reader of all kinds of romance. I don't really care about that. But I got the impression initially when I started this book that Helen, much like what her family thinks, that Helen was just sowing some oats, that this wasn't necessarily, you know, I don't know that I would say that she, what her sexuality was, and everyone can define that how they want. But I feel like Helen initially, I got the impression like she's just going to sow some oats with Paris. And I don't know. I like them together. And you're right. What better way to start than I'm going to murder her?
Yeah. It's a fine line between like wanting to kill your hot partner and wanting to like maybe kiss them. I don't know.
It's fair. I have days that I still am like, you know, I could stab him in his sleep and he wouldn't know. Like, it would be fine.
It's chemistry. I don't know.
I know. He edits our podcast, so it's not like he doesn't know that I say these things.
He's going to be listening to this like within a couple of days for sure. Amazing.
Yeah. So this is actually your first book for adults, because you have some books for kids too. Yes. How was the writing and publishing of this process been different for you this time around?
It's interesting. So I didn't actually write this book after I wrote those books. I'm sort of publishing in reverse order that I've actually written them, which is interesting. So Better Left Buried was my YA debut last year. And I actually wrote that one latest. So I wrote that one in 2020. And then I have We Are the Match I wrote in 2019. And then the book I have coming out this fall with Disney, which is another YA thriller, I wrote in 2018. So the writing process, it was very early on in my career. I had a lot of unsold work when I came to my current agent. I'd had an agent before who just like didn't move as fast as Claire Friedman, who moves faster than anybody. And so she's sold a lot of books for me. And I have deals across genres now, which is really fun. So in terms of the writing of this, I toyed with the idea of making it YA initially. And then I toyed with the idea of making it fantasy. So this has had a lot of different iterations, but I love the one we settled on. I feel like it was the right venue for this modern exploration of, you know, when I went between YA and adult with this one, I was like, actually, I really feel like this is still sort of a coming of age story like you might find in young adult. Yeah. But you see, because of the trauma they both experience, that they don't actually have that experience until they're adults. And part of what facilitates their coming of age is each other and the freedom they find with each other. And I think that was really fun to return to. I wrote it before I was with my current partner, my fiance. And it was really fun to return to and edit when I had this like different basis for like the freedom I have found with my partner and being able to explore that side of things with Helen and Paris. So it's definitely been a journey to get here, but I love the eventual route I found. And it was a really roundabout sort of, this book has had many different iterations, but this one we settled on with Montlake was really a fun place for the story to land, I think.
And I can see how you could have done some finagling and made this YA. To me, it reads like new adult, which is a category that we've talked about on this podcast so many times, because I'm a librarian. There is not a category in libraries or bookstores for new adult. You are either in YA or you're in adult. And actually, I just had this issue last week. our head of collection development called me and was like, hey, we got in all the Binding 13 books by Chloe Walsh, and they're all listed as YA, but they have these really like big triggers warnings at the beginning, content warnings. And she's like, I'm not so certain that we want to put these in YA. And I work in like a really small rural community. And so, and it's, you know, a very conservative community in Virginia. And I was like, yeah, I actually thought they were adults, so I'm fine with moving them. Because yeah, you do one or two little things and you can move that line so quickly. I wish we had a true category for new adult, because honestly, 17 to 24, 25, like that range, that's a whole other coming of age story, right?
Absolutely.
And that's where like a book like this, I feel like would fit really well. But the girls in this, the women in this, they're 30, right? About 30.
28.
Okay. I may have aged them up a little too much, but
yeah, that's okay.
I'm 20s. In my 40s. So
they're whatever age you want them to be. I wrote them in late 20s because I think that they do really fall into that new adult space. And I think people tend to, I think in the young adult, but new adult readership tends to read up a little bit. So I was also actually a teacher prior to becoming a writer. I taught much younger children, but all children read up. In middle grade, 8-year-olds want to read about 10-year-olds. 14-year-olds want to read about 17-year-olds. And 18-year-olds have no interest in reading about a 16-year-old. They want to read about a 20-year-old. And I think that kind of continues even in for folks in the early 20s. If you're like in college and you're 21-ish, like you're wanting to read about maybe someone who shares your experience and your age, but maybe someone who's like just a few years further than you, and you kind of can explore safely what it might be like to be that age and that kind of life. And I don't know. It's interesting. I hear you about the new adult category, though. I think that it's really like it tried to become a thing several years ago. I was around for that era of publishing. And then it was sort of written off because it was just like smut about 22-year-olds, which is fine and cool. Like, and like love smut, obviously wrote some in my book.
Same.
But like, it kind of was only that. And so I think a lot of people were like, we don't really know what to do with this. And I think now with like the romanticy resurgence, I think we're seeing a lot more push to have new adult as a category, but it still doesn't have a place in the library. Like that is really what it comes down to. Libraries and bookstores don't have that categorization yet. So it's tricky. But I think
what's really cool about that subset for new adult is that there are so many readers as teenagers that are moving into adult content, hopefully as adults. Although when I was teaching middle school, I had an eighth grader who was reading Colleen Hoover, and I was just like, oh man. But it scares me too. I was like, do you know what you're reading? Like, I don't think that's the best idea. And then she read 50 Shades of Grey later, and I was like, this is worse. Like, I feel like we need to draw a line. But I'm excited that people are continuing their reading journey. You know what I mean? Sure. Because I'm an advocate for literacy, and I want reading of all kinds, and I try not to judge people about their reading, but I kind of judge eighth graders that read Colleen Hoover. But, you know, I just think we need to make space for it, and it needs to be 20-year-olds that are not just smut, because you're right. I feel like you're absolutely nailed it on that subset had only been like smutty books. But then you have books like, I don't know if you've read Fangirl by Rainbow Rowell. It's one of my favorite books. That book takes place when she's a freshman in college, but it's in the YA section. That's a new adult book.
For sure.
There's no smut in it.
Yeah.
It's just, and it's a really good coming of age story. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. And I want to be so careful. Like I don't want to write the category off as just smut and also to talk down about smut, because I love smut. And I actually, I know there's a really nuanced conversation to be had about sex in YA books in general. And I know when I was a teenager reading YA, books that could respectfully portray realistic sex between characters were so helpful. I grew up in a rural conservative community.
Yeah.
And so, like, sometimes those are your only sex ed books. Sometimes that is your only portrayal of consent.
Yeah.
Sometimes that is the only reason you figure out as a teenager that the way someone has been interacting with you, like a girlfriend or boyfriend or partner, is not okay when you can see it on the pages. And so I think it's so important. And I think it's important in new adults when you're navigating so many big life decisions. But I think it's also really important to have just kind of a diverse array of stories in that age category, yes. Because if it's just smut for the smut readers, like good for the smut readers, they deserve to eat.
Yeah.
We love them.
Yeah.
I love but a smut. Also, I think there are some folks who, I mean, especially I think post pandemic, there is a whole group of folks in their late teens and early 20s who are actually a lot more inexperienced in the area of like sex and relationships, because so much of yeah. those really formative years where you learn to connect with folks in person yeah. was taken. And I think that
yeah.
having books where you can sort of really safely explore like a first kiss, even if you're maybe an older teenager or a young 20 or yeah. something, or a yeah. first sexual experience. Like I think going right to smut would be really overwhelming for someone who maybe their life yes. experience doesn't quite match,
yes.
which I know we're on a tangent now, but I really, I can talk forever.
No, I think this is a good conversation. I love it. Yeah. And I think that both of us having experience working with kids, we probably have a different viewpoint as well sure. because of that. But I mean, I'm never really a fan of open door in a YA novel. I'm mm-hmm. fine with there being content, but I mm-hmm. just don't want the explicit content because I do feel like there is a place for that. And I don't think mm-hmm. it's for kids. YA is 12 through 18, right? Mm-hmm. So I have a 12-year-old and I don't really want him reading the books that are on my shelf. Like he for has sure. a shelf that's just for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
These are the ones you can read.
Yeah. I think like wherever parents set that boundary is like, is mm-hmm. fine, because I think that your family, like your values within your family and how you protect your kids are mm-hmm. like, that's important. And you like every parent sets that. And I think that some of the stories I've had that really do that well. There is a story that is, it's called, I think it's Not Your Love Story. And oh, Have a Little Faith in Me. And it's about a girl, mm-hmm. a teenage girl. It's a YA novel. And it's about mm-hmm. this girl who goes to church camp to win back this boy. And he was her first boyfriend.
Always a good reason to go to church camp.
Oh, absolutely. It's hilarious because it's written by someone who came from the really conservative Christian background as a kid. Yeah. But she's writing a character who's not. So what this character kind of doesn't know about all the ins and outs of religious, like makes the book really funny. But she's had sex. The boy is like, hey, we had sex and that makes you really bad and dirty. And so I have to go back and like go to Jesus. And she's like, I can win you back. And so she goes to camp and she tries to win him back. And then she realizes some of the nuances of like what it means to be a girl and have a sexuality and want to have sex.
Yeah.
And she's like 16 or 17, I think. And there is yeah. on-page sex, but it's done so, so well. Like I'd recommend to any mm-hmm. teenager, even on the younger end, I think like in that, but you know, that's not really relevant to the book that I've written, which is not for children. Please do not.
Not for children.
This is not,
this one's not for children.
It starts with a threesome and it gets worse. Like,
yeah.
please.
Literally.
Not give this to your children.
Would it be okay if I read the first sentence of your book?
Yes, please do.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Not the first sentence. I want to read the first couple paragraphs, if that's okay.
Yeah,
this is how this book starts. On this side of the island where the cliffs are stark white and brutal and the people are crammed together in small apartments like dolls in a dollhouse, your neighbors can hear every scream. Or in Thea's case, moan. She and Pierce, is it Pierce or Percy?
It's Purse.
Purse. That's mm-hmm. what I kind of thought. She and Purse are in my bed, as usual, on a Saturday night, and the three of us have spent it as we always have, fucking, arguing about business, and then fucking again. So I yeah. read that
Don't
first
give it to
part.
Your kids.
Don't give this to your kids. I read that first part, took a picture of it, and sent it to my group chat with Molly and our other best friend, Katie, and was just like, what a fucking way to start a book. With a bang.
Quite literally, like, yes.
It starts the expectations right there. Mm-hmm. And yes, so this one's not for kids, but it's interesting. I just want to side note, and then we'll go back to questions. You said Disney is one of your publishers too. So you mm-hmm. have several publishers as well, which is really awesome.
Yeah. So YA is with Disney, and then I write middle grade with Aladdin, and my first middle grade title is out next year. And then I write romantasy with Putnam. So I just sold a book called Bromantasy.
Goodness.
Which is one of the silliest
things. It's called Romantasy?
No, it's called Bromantasy. And it's about two really dumb farmer best friends who are only best friends and definitely don't have any feelings for each other, who accidentally sign up to go on a quest they're really underqualified for. And then along the way, mm-hmm. they like realize that without like the door and the walls between them, they're like a little bit in love and also maybe yeah. drive each other crazy. And also nobody has a brain cell. So it's really a silly book, but it's with a different publisher.
Do you have a release date for that? Because I absolutely need you to come back on the podcast with that book.
It's going to be next June, probably. I think they're aiming for Pride. So yeah, I would love to.
We got you next year. I'm gonna pencil you in because that sounds amazing. I'm the mom of two boys, and it's bro or bruh in this house all the time. I'm like, gosh. Or mom, you could try that. Or they'll say your mom, and then like I'm both of your mom. Like you can't your mom joke your sibling.
Oh no, I think you can. My siblings and I do this frequently.
That's amazing. Okay, so this story is marketed as a modern Helen of Troy story. Can you talk about how you were inspired to write the story and how this book relates to the classic story of the Trojan War?
Yeah, I've always loved Helen of Troy. I've always found that myth really fascinating. And I have always thought that the like idea that there could be a woman so beautiful that she is somehow at fault for all the choices men make is just always really relevant to the world around us.
Yep.
And I wanted to explore that. And I wanted to explore it in this like very female-centric gaze. Like I think so much of the myth of Helen of Troy is always about how she's so irresistible to men and how men's decisions are impacted by how she looks. And we don't really, I think there are many retellings, of course, like I'm not saying I'm the first to do a retelling in which that imagines what Helen herself is thinking. There are certainly many on the market that do this, but I really wanted to imagine it her solely through the gaze of other women. Like I wrote this book for gay women, and I wrote this book for women who want to deconstruct the male gaze and think more along the lens of the female gaze. And so that was a piece of why I wanted to explore this way. How Paris sees her is so different than how the men in her life see her. Even the men she loves, even the men like Tommy who care for her, like Tommy is her bodyguard who has known her since she was a child, since a baby, and has cared for her and loves her and is very much a father figure in her life. But he also sees her as this like person he wants to protect. And Paris sees her as an equal on the same footing.
Yes.
And I think that is, and also Paris, because Paris sees that, Paris is able to challenge Helen on the ways Helen herself is complicit in these like really messed up power structures that she upholds.
Yeah.
So I think that was a piece of it. I loved the beginning of the myth of Helen of Troy is where Eris throws a golden apple addressed to the fairest into a party where all of the gods are. And Paris is one who's supposed to figure out who threw the apple. And in this case, it's a literal grenade that says, instead of to the fairest, it says from the queen. And so the parallels there are sort of how we kick things off. Yeah. I thought that some of that imagery was just really fun to play with in a really, really, really gay context. So we could boil all this down to like make mythology gay. Gayer.
So I was going to say it is a little gay already.
It is pretty gay.
But people that go into this thinking that this is going to be the story of the Trojan War, it really isn't. It really is the story of Helen. I mean, she and Paris are the main characters, and it's told from both their point of views. But this isn't like reading the Iliad. It's not like that.
No, and I think that it might be a better to pitch this as sort of a prequel to something like that. It's the beginning of the
Trojan absolutely. War.
It is the moment that they leave for Troy together, this catalyst is very much something that happens later in their story and in this book. And I think that it's almost sort of a prequel to those events. Helen and Paris leaving and exploding everything behind them.
Which is a great way to take this story because you are looking at it as, you know, how the women are impacted and not necessarily how the men, because the story that was written down was about the men.
Yes.
It wasn't about Helen.
What is so bad about being somebody's queen that you had to burn it all down and run? Like, what was so bad about that, that you fled in the night and gave up all of this power that you supposedly had? Like, that was the question that sort of pushed this book forward for me. And I think that's the question I wanted to ask. And I think some readers are probably going to be disappointed that it's not more Trojan War-esque and it's not more of the, like, man story, for lack of a better word, but I really wanted this to be like Helen's why. Like, what is pushing her to get out, and what is it about Paris that makes her feel free enough to make this choice that so many other people would view as like insane? So
Honestly, I think that that's what made it better, that it isn't a retelling of the Iliad or the Trojan War. Mm-hmm. It is a story of two people who find each other in impossible mm-hmm. circumstances. Like mm-hmm. there is no reason that they should love each other. They mm-hmm. they start with literally, "I'm going to kill her," mm-hmm. and I just thought that is a good story. And it's why I liked it. Like I'm not one to sugarcoat. I liked this book, and I'll tell you what, and I'm not going to give any spoilers to listeners because you need to get this book when it comes out in July. But the last, probably 6 to 10 chapters, I was like, I don't want to be at work right now. All I want to do is go home and read. Like, I don't want to do anything else. I need to know what happens because it's just so intense. And I mean, there's a great building arc to that. And then the way it ends, I mean, I texted you after I messaged you on, yeah. on TikTok. Cause I was just like, oh,
that is,
it really got me.
My favorite booksellers at Tropes and Trifles sent me a text that was just like all caps screaming after they read. And then I won't give spoilers either for some of what they were screaming at me about, but they were like, yeah, I've just been like, you know, texting our other mutual friend who's also read this book and just been like complaining about you. And I was like, thank you. That's so nice.
So I'm that's glad what that you want to hear, right? It was so good that I'm having an emotional reaction, and that's where I was. So
yeah. Oh, I'm glad. I mean, this story has been with me for so many years, and it's really fun to see to finally have it with people who are reading and enjoying it for the first time. That's really fun.
And it is good. So pick it up. All right. So this is a sapphic romance with mafia enemies to lovers tropes. Based on your acknowledgments, I know that you say you write love stories for your partner. And where does the enemies to lovers inspiration come from?
I mean, not in my real life, because I was obsessed with them immediately. Like, there's this joke in lesbian culture specifically about going full U-Haul as soon as you meet somebody. Yes. And we did. We met because of writing. We met online on a writing Discord. And then we had met two times in person before they came to live with me. We are who we are, and we're getting married in a couple months now. So
yay, that's so exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. We weren't actually together when they moved in. We were like, their housing was like in a kind of unstable spot. And I was like, just come and stay with me for a while. And then it just developed from there. So no enemies to lovers in our lives. We are just like very deeply obsessed with each other. Our birthdays are a week apart. Mine was last weekend and theirs is this weekend. And we
happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. So we both separately, without obviously telling each other, planned surprise parties a week apart with like all of our families and friends, which is the gayest thing that's ever happened. Like, and all of our friends were like my brother was like, yeah, we got messages from you about 45 minutes apart being like, hey, that's I'm planning this thing. And they were like, we all deserve so much credit for not accidentally texting the wrong group chats, because you put us in two different group chats to plan each other's surprise birthday parties. And anyway, so no, we are the polar opposites of Helen and Paris here. It's a little bit embarrassing, actually.
I can't speak for that, because my husband and I, that was the exact thing for us. We met online. We were matched through a dating website, and we're in our 40s. And so it's been a while. It was an old, dating website. We went on 4 dates in 1 week, and then he pretty much stayed at my apartment and never left. And he was on leave. He was literally a sailor on leave, because he was in the Coast Guard, and he was home on leave, and he was staying at his parents. And then he just wasn't. He was just at my apartment. Mm-hmm. And then I went with him to Texas that summer. I didn't do any school stuff, and I went with him to Texas that summer because he was transferring. And then I never left. So
I love this. That's so romantic.
It is. I feel like I was a little crazy. I only knew him for a few months, and I moved across the country, but I guess it worked out, because this month is 15 years that we've been married. So
congratulations. That's so cool.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. 16 years together, 15 married. We have got 2 kids. We've lived in 4 states. Military life. It's a lot.
Yeah. Sorry, I get that. Yes, I do. Wow.
But it's so funny that you say this because I am not a fan of insta-love. Like, that's not a trope I like. And I'm like, yeah, that's weird though, because that's what I have.
No, I don't like insta-love as a reader. I don't like it at all.
Yeah.
And yet they fall in love so fast in this book. And it's in part because my partner and I were just immediately enamored. Like, I did that in the most, like, if I had written our love story into a book, editors everywhere would be like, unrealistic insta-love. And to that, yeah, I would say you've never met lesbians, but you know, that's not. That's
so, I mean, yeah, they do fall in love quickly in this story, but there's enough of a, like, they're enough guarded that it's not insta-love. They protect themselves.
They do. And they like hate each other a lot. So that helps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man. I'm sorry if this is a spoiler, but the scene where Helen comes to Paris's apartment and ends up chained to her bed.
Yeah, I mean,
I was laughing so hard. I was like, this is amazing.
Yeah, and Paris is so mean because she's like, well, he didn't say for it, so I am going to just leave you tied up here.
Yeah, and then Tommy's like, where is she? It's amazing.
Oh, and then man. Okay. Walk in with Helen like that. Yeah, that was one of my favorite scenes to write and to make my partner read, because I write romance and spicy scenes to make them blush. Like, that's why I do it. So if you
love
there is an unhinged scene somewhere, it is because I want Aaron to be blushing when they read it. But just need you all to know that.
Love it. I am here for that. All right. So speaking of enemies to lovers, let's get to the meat of the story. So Paris and Helen are our main characters, and the book is in dual narration. How do you approach writing each voice?
Yeah, I felt like they were so distinct to me immediately. This book has always been dual POV, and I really felt like Paris has this like abrupt kind of anger in everything, and she has short sentences. She has like really direct and to the point narration internally, and also when she speaks to people. And then Helen's, I wanted to feel so detached at first, and then have these moments where she's like really sharply in her body. So a lot of what I wrote about with Helen was some feelings of dissociation and feeling like she's not really always in her body because of the things she's experienced. And because she has to be so, so controlled. And so like she has to watch her face. And Paris is like, I'm going to let everyone see the RBF. Yeah. I want all of you to know how much I hate you. I want you to read it right here. And Helen is like, I have to make nice with everybody. I have to be like polite and controlled. So I think in so many ways, they're like on these opposite ends of a spectrum. So when I was writing, it could be hard to switch between voices because to me, they were so different. But I found it was a fun challenge to write to write two women who are both really flawed and in pain, but in very different ways.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you write it like linearly? Did you alternate between the chapters when you were writing, or did you write several from one point of view and then several from the other?
No, I went like chronologically, like every other, a few scenes that really were burning up in me, I wrote like just before I got there, but generally I write chronologically only. So,
Well, I have to say, I have read books before that are dual POVs that are a man and a woman, and I've gotten confused about whose chapter we're in, and we're talking about two different brains.
Two different genders,
So if anyone is worried about being confused as to which woman's point of view this is, you won't do that. You will not be confused because it is very, very distinct voices. Like, they are very distinct. They both have rage, but it's a different kind of rage with Helen versus Paris. You nailed it. All right. So next, from the very beginning of the book, we know that Paris is seeking revenge for the ruthless bombing that caused the death of her sisters. Her plan is to kill Helen to exact revenge on Helen's father, Zarek, for that bombing. Helen's father is essentially the head of the families, which is the mafia, but the women are drawn to each other romantically instead. I personally feel like you did a really fantastic job building tension between Paris and Helen, and I was wondering if you could tell us how you tackled that in your own writing.
Yeah, that is a little bit more drawn from real life, I think. The chemistry and the attraction and the tension there. And I think that the death knell of so many books that is just convenience. And so I wanted to think of like what would be the most inconvenient circumstances for both of them. And then I put them in there. I think that was a piece of how I created some of that tension. But I also, one of my favorite books I have read is Strange the Dreamer by Lainey Taylor. And she has these characters you root for really, really deeply who have polar opposite goals. And so something that was important to me as I created this story, I was like, how can their goals be so diametrically opposed that you both have readers wanting each of them to accomplish their goals and knowing they cannot both accomplish their goals essentially and still both survive or be together. But like, I wanted to create like the tension that way, but also the tension between, you know, Helen is the embodiment of everything that took Paris's life away from her. And in some ways, Paris is also the embodiment of everything that took Helen's feeling of safety with her family away from her, because Helen's past is that she has lost her mom in a really devastating bombing and had that kind of reshaped her life. And so they both are so antithetical to each other that they can't really, like, reaching across that divide at all causes a stir. And I think at some level that was easy to write, because as a queer person in a queer relationship, reaching for my partner in the world that we exist in causes a stir, even if we're just loving each other. Like that, I think that is such an allegory for the queer experience, is that being together at all is this thing that is so dangerous to existing power structures that they crumble around us just by loving each other. And so I think that was really kind of foundational to this story, and especially revising it in the last couple of years, well, in a queer relationship with a queer person, and we're getting married and like wondering if we're going to have the right to get married anymore. Those are things that are under attack all around us. And so rewriting this tension between Helen and Paris of like, we can't be together and all we want is each other, but that is opposed to our like external goals. Like they can't work with that. And I think that's just like a really like accurate depiction of what it's like to be queer in the world in general, but in this country, in the US. So like that's a piece of it.
I mean, that's one of the things we talked about in our episode last week with the author AJ West, because his book, The Betrayal of Thomas True, is a queer historical novel that takes place in London in the 1700s. And we were talking about how things haven't changed significantly in England. I mean, it's no longer illegal to be gay there, but there's still this thought that this is, quote unquote, this is what AJ said, that it's quote unquote unnatural. And it's just like, if those are your feelings, how can that be unnatural? Like that's
right.
That doesn't make sense.
I think that queer love threatens existing power structures, because if you look at whether it's England or the United States or any country that has engaged in rampant imperialism, their so much of their power relies on being able to control people in these kind of false hierarchies they've created around class, around race, around religion, all of these things where these false hierarchies between people that are sort of like predicated on the binary, the like of many kinds, like you're either this or you're that. You either have power or you don't. And when you have, and marriages have to be a reflection of that. They have to be a man and a woman. They have to be like this very binary thing. And like, I think being queer is in direct opposition to empire. So be gayer, everybody. that's the message of the book. Get gayer.
That's good advice for everybody. I mean, I just personally, I am a straight woman in a heterosexual marriage, and there's nothing about a gay marriage that devalues mine. I think that idea is absolutely, it's asinine. It doesn't have any common sense wrapped in it. I think you've got that down right there. I think that that's a really good way of looking at it. This book is definitely timely. I agree with that. And also I want to say, like, the setting is modern, but I also feel like there's not a clear like time period that this takes place in. So it could be futuristic. It could be current. Like that's the vibes I got. Like I felt like it could really be any time, which isn't easy to do. So this book has a lot of moving pieces and characters. So can you break down the structure, or at least like the heads of each of the families for the mafia?
Yeah. So the kind of core conflict is that there used to be more and now there's one. So prior to this book beginning, Helen's mother was from Troy, and Helen's father, Zarek, who's now the head of the crime families, is from the island she currently lives on. And they used to be two powerful crime families that were joined when Zarek, Helen's father, and Lena, Helen's mother, got married. And then Helen's mother was killed in an attack by Troy, by her original crime family, in a move against Zarek's power because they thought instead of sharing this power, he wanted to consolidate it. So they were like, "We are no longer your allies." And split. And then his response was to sort of rain hellfire down upon them and destroyed all of Troy. And there are a few other smaller kind of tangential families who used to be sort of allies or used to be, they would have like partnerships as far as weapons or whatever else. And they kind of all got pulled into Zarek's reign. And so Altea, Hana, and Frona are three heads of these smaller houses that all sort of have to answer to Zarek now. So there used to be many, many crime families, and kind of the core issue that many of them have with Zarek is that he pulled condensed all the power to himself. And then instead of working with these existing families that have been there forever, he's now gone outside of their families to the person he's trying to marry Helen off to, who's the head of a shipping company, who is like willing to cross some lines around legality. And so Zarek thinks he can bring in this other powerful, wealthy person who will answer only to him because this person is new to the world and is also marrying his daughter. So he's trying to coalesce all of his power, and Helen is being used to do it and wants out.
She's being used as a pawn. I mean, and that's historically what we see happen with women, right? They're pawns. But the thing about her is that she's very smart and she's pretty freaking powerful, which actually brings me to my next question. There is a, I'm going to rephrase this. This Molly wrote this question, but I'm going to rephrase it slightly. There's discussion about Helen being a god, a goddess. Do you intend for her to actually be literally a goddess, or is that more that she's just so powerful that she's like a god?
More that she's so powerful that she's like a god. There was an iteration of this book where I think where there was a hint of like speculative elements. And when I revised it to a modern setting, I kind of wanted to keep this lingering question in people's heads where they feel this power and they kind of fear it because they don't know how far it extends or what it entails. And I kind of wanted to keep that vibe and that sort of sense of timelessness that you mentioned, is I wanted it to feel almost modern, but also like you've stepped into something else that you don't quite understand. And so she's not a literal god, and she doesn't have literal godlike powers. But I think that the metaphor I wanted to maintain, because sometimes people look at people in positions of power and they think they are gods or kings when they are not. And the best way to rob them of that power is to call their bluff and to refuse to participate in their structures of power and violence. And I think that's kind of what this is so much about.
That's good advice. this book actually reminded me a little bit of, and then you may think this is weird, but it kind of reminded me of the Romeo plus Juliet that Baz, what's his last name? Lerman made in like the 90s that was Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think so. It's a I am gonna Google it because there was a Romeo and Juliet I saw long ago. Yes, I have
So
seen
this one, yeah, so this one's like the families are more gangs than they are just royal families. And I feel like the mafia element of this like gave me those vibes. Like the coloring that they use in the movie, like it just felt like I could see that this would fit into that world, even though they take place in completely different time periods and they're not from the same root story at all. I was just like, I want to rewatch that now because it's making me feel like that. And actually, I should say that's one of my favorite movies. So this is a compliment. I mean it that
Yeah, thank you. I thought that was really fun, and I was obsessed with it as a kid. I was obsessed with Romeo and Juliet more broadly, and doomed love stories are just kind of always something that I have enjoyed.
Well, I liked when I taught high school. My first few years, I taught freshmen, and we did Romeo and Juliet. And I liked to show them that movie version because I felt like it was much more relatable to like real life than the old version, which honestly, I didn't think the acting was that great in that one. But you know, I don't know. Anyway, so there are some side characters I want to talk about without giving any spoilers. I need to preface that. No spoilers. First, this book literally starts with a bang. We talked about that. So Paris is finishing up her sexual exploits with Thea and Perse. Thea's a woman who grew up with Paris, and Perse is Thea's husband. The three appear to frequently have trysts with one another, but Thea is closely aligned with the families. Can you explain the complicated intricacies of their relationship? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, I think that Paris and Thea are the only two people left alive who understand each other's experience of the world. Yeah. And I think that that is what draws them together more than anything, is that they are the only reason the other person isn't kind of alone. Even though Thea has this really like beautiful marriage with Perse and is very happy with him.
Yeah.
That they represent this, the last piece of their old life for each other. And I think that Thea's decision to work with the families was as much a survival choice as Paris's decision not to was. And I think that deeper than what we see on page, this is very much just like what it's like to try to exist ethically in a world that is really opposed to your existence at all. And so Thea makes this choice to ally herself with power, and Paris makes this choice to burn it down. And that kind of creates some conflict between them. And they both think of each other as kind of complicit in this in different ways and a problem in different ways. Yeah. But deeply underneath that, they are the reason the other person's not alone. They're the reason somebody else remembers and understands. And it is, and no spoilers, but I did find that relationship really fun to write, because they're mad at each other at many points. They don't understand each other at many points, but ultimately they really have this loyalty that's fiercer and goes deeper than that because they have this shared background.
Yeah. I feel like if you ever wrote another book in this world, I would like their story, Perse, and Thea's story. Because I think that there is a depth there that we don't expect, and I'm not giving any spoilers, but there's some stuff that happens that I'm like, there's way more to them and I want to know it. I want to know what's going on with them. So I have
a kind of a novella written about them, actually. So I love that you said that.
Yes.
This is dependent on my publisher. I don't get any decision making in this. My publisher, if readers like them and want these characters, I will write them happily.
Okay. Well, I love Thea. This reader.
Yes. This is going to be, maybe this is a stretch, but I felt very like Katniss and Peeta vibes about those two, about Thea and Perse. Mm-hmm. And Thea is this like mean badass, takes no shit, and Perse is this like hopeful, kind person. Yeah. And I think the reason Thea loves him so deeply is because he gives her this hope, just in a really similar way to Peeta being this reason Katniss has like hope to hang on to. So
He would definitely like show up with cupcakes and be like, okay, you're here, let's eat cupcakes, and then let's go, you know, let's go do things.
Absolutely. It is a much spicier version of Peeta.
Exactly. But I definitely feel the Katniss and Peeta vibes for sure. All right. So next I want to talk about Milos and Marcus. So these brothers represent one, they're not the families, they're a shipping conglomerate, I guess. Zarek's plan is to marry Helen to Milos for a treaty of sorts, but these brothers are messy. So what can you share with our listeners about them?
Yeah. Okay. So Marcus is the younger one. He's like very volatile and very messy and very violent. And then Milos is the older brother, and he is supposed to be sort of the head of this family. And much like Helen, he kind of has to ride this line of keeping up like a nice kind of diplomatic face towards the outside world, both in his like corporate side of his work and also in this really intense crime family side of the world. And he also, I think that Milos and Helen are really kind of two sides of the same coin. And I think in some ways, Marcus and Paris are also.
Yeah, and I can see that.
Also importantly, I wanted to write everybody as being really hot and messy. So this is like, really, I wrote about them being this way because I was like, I want you to maybe feel attracted to everybody on page. And I want you to get to the most problematic character and be like, daddy. So you know, that is really like, I could have a deeper answer than that, but I just wanted to make everybody hot.
I mean, everybody was hot in this book. That is very true.
I get bored if they're not, so.
It's fair. That's fair. I felt like I wanted to, like, just hug Milos because mm-hmm. I just wanted to pat him on the head. Aw. Mm-hmm. Aw, honey. Yes. I'm not going to give spoilers, though. You know, all right, finally, let's...
Go ahead. I wanted him to, like, have... I didn't want him to be this, like, cookie-cutter villain who's, like, taking advantage of Helen. Like, very much at the core of his character is that he really actually thinks he loves her. Like, he thinks there is this spark between them. And he just really thinks that it's possible for them to forge a relationship when Helen has no power. And he doesn't see the power differences because he has all the power, which is really common, I think. And he's not... kind of at his heart, he's not any worse of a person than any of them are, even if Helen and Iris definitely think he is. So I wanted that complexity to be there on page.
It's definitely there. He's definitely there. And he's definitely hot. Like, I can... he's hot.
Most important part.
Right, of course. Finally, let's talk about Tommy. He's definitely one of my favorite characters in the book. So Tommy has been responsible for Helen literally since the day she was born and her mother handed her to him. He's a character of character, but he's not afraid to get his hands dirty for Helen. Is Tommy inspired by anyone in your life, or is he really completely a well-rounded figment of your imagination?
Oh, I love Tommy. I think Tommy's my favorite character. This is hard to answer. Tommy has pieces of different people I've known, people who were very protective, people who were very... like, I am going to do whatever I have to do to keep me and my family safe kind of energy. Yeah. And I respect that. And I also see its limitations, you know?
Yeah.
So I wanted to explore that a little bit in this, like, how far does that, like, love of your family and your people take you? And what can you justify in the name of that love too? Because Tommy certainly does some bad things. They all do. This is very much a morally gray collection of people. And I've already had some readers kind of take issue with the fact that everyone here makes really bad choices and doesn't always get held accountable for them. And I think that's kind of the point, is that when you exist in a world where there are no good choices, you make bad choices. Like, there are no ethical choices to make and still maintain, like, yourself and your dignity and your safety and your humanity even. But I love Tommy. I love him so much. He certainly has, like, a really strong moral compass despite who he works for. And I think he is really maybe the most aware of his own failure at being a truly moral person. But he certainly loves Helen and he wants better for her. I think the target of Tommy is that he is willing to do bad things if it keeps her safe long enough for her to get to freedom. Like, that's what he ultimately wants for her, is for her to be free of this world that forces bad decisions on her. Yeah. He wants her to have a better version of things. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he's definitely one of my favorite characters from this book. And I don't think this describes him physically at all, but he reminds me of Charlie Swan. Like, I just get the dad vibes from him. Like, he would, you know, be fiercely protective and be like, no, you're too good for that person. Like, no, we're not doing that. And it's hard to say that he's a good man when he does do some bad things, but he's a good man. And in this world, he's probably and in this world, he's probably one of the better of the people. I mean, it's a mafia, so, you know, you get you get what it says, you know.
It does what it says in the box.
Exactly. So I want to pivot for a moment and talk about the sex in the book, the smuttiness. So there are definitely some scenes that are explicit, but the majority of what's happening is kind of happening behind closed doors. How do you approach spicy scenes, especially as writing this as an adult author, as opposed to writing for kids?
Yeah, I mean, I love a spicy scene. This is actually on the tamer side of what I've written. So I just turned in my second book in this contract, which is not a Greek mythology retelling, but it is a dark romance. And I turned it into my editor, and I haven't yet gotten an edit letter on it. And so I don't know how much I can say about it, but it has like 11 sex scenes that are on page because every time I got stuck, I wrote a sex scene. And they are spicy, spicy. Like this is, this is kind of tame in comparison. It's not that tame. They definitely do some kinky things, which is fun to explore on page. But they, so I enjoyed a lot. It's definitely, I'm hoping that there's enough distinction in my branding and work around it that my teenage readers are going to take a couple years before they decide to try to pick this one up. But I think that dark romance speaks for itself. So, you know, there are certainly like, there are certainly some moments between Helen and Paris and also between Paris and other people, honestly, that are just very, very sexy, very sapphic. This book is for the women is what it's for.
I mean, there's even one in the pool, so I was just like, oh, okay, that happened.
I my editor was like, I think more needs to happen in this scene, and I was like, enough happens. Sorry to my editor, she was right. I did have to add some more attention to that scene when I was initially revising, but I was like, I wrote this one for the vibes.
That's all. There's vibes there. I got it. All right. So this is our kind of favorite question to ask authors. Are you a pantser? Are you a plotter?
I am a reformed pantser. I love pantsing a book. I love not having a roadmap, but traditional publishing doesn't really allow for that. So most of what I sell now is on proposal, which means that I write 30 to 50 pages, sometimes a little longer. I wrote Romanticy. I sold on a 100-page proposal, but within my genres that I've already sold in, I write 30 to 50 pages and then I write a synopsis. And then when I actually write the book, the synopsis, I tend to follow it mostly. There are things that I veer off of. I have a pretty loose structure. I actually, when I start a book, even when I would pants, I knew the sort of climax of the novel. I knew the like really intense point that I wanted to get to. So then I think the reason pantsing worked for me is that I could just sort of write tension escalating to this crescendo. So I usually knew that and how it wrapped up, and I knew the premise. And so then the in-between parts was muddier and I enjoyed exploring that. And that is the one thing I miss about, you know, being a traditionally published author. I think if I were going the indie route, I would be able to do a bit more pantsing, but unfortunately outlining does work. I hate to tell all the pantsers out there. Hate that advice for myself. Me 5 years ago would be really ready for fighting, but so it's way easier to edit if you plotted.
So Molly is a writer. And she is also a reformed pantser. It's how she prefers to write. It's just whatever the invisible friends in her head tell her to do. But she's currently writing something that has so much world building that is necessary that she has really become a plotter. And I love that for her, and I'm also a little annoyed because I just want to read the book.
Like, yeah.
Just write the fucking book, Molly. Like, I just want to read it. Like, as the reader of the group, like, I don't really care. I just want to read it.
Yeah, so you want it to be done in your inbox. Yeah.
Yeah. But she's doing so much research that, which, you know, this is something that we've talked about on this podcast before. We talked about this with Beth Revis earlier this season. You write sci-fi or fantasy, that doesn't mean that you can't have research. Like, you have to still build your world around something that's real, or it won't be accessible to readers.
Yeah. You have to have it grounded enough that it makes sense. Yeah. For sure.
I mean, I don't know how we get to fairies fucking, but we do. I don't know.
We do. Yeah.
Me too.
I mean, what was that one book that was really popular? It like blew up on TikTok or BookShock. It was the blue alien one, the
Ice Planet Barbarians.
Yeah, giant blue cocks. You know, I don't know what kind of world building she did, but it worked for her. So like, mad power to her for that.
We read that for one of our seasons, and now I can't remember which one, but I laughed a lot. But have you read that book? Have you read it?
No, I've heard they're like compulsively readable and also really fun. So
yes, and yes, but my issue with that book is that the meet cute is her unconscious, him deciding that it's his mate, that she's his mate, and pulling her pants down and going down on her. And to that ruined the whole thing. Cause I'm like, that's assault.
Right. Yeah.
Like, I don't care that she enjoyed it. That's assault. Right.
Yeah, but I think there's a lot of readers who like that particular trope of the, like, you've been kidnapped and you have to have sex kind of. And, like, I don't, no shade to them. It's just not, like, for me, that would be kind of triggering stop to what I was enjoying, even though there are many things that are kind of dubious consent on page that I think are fun to read. But I think everyone's like line for what dubious consent becomes non-consensual or not. Like, listen, if you're reading non-consensual stuff in fiction and you enjoy it, there's also nothing morally wrong. I'm not the thought police. I don't think that translates to real stuff, but like your personal line of what's dubious consent or non-consent or non-consent, but in a scary way, like that's super personal. But for me, I wouldn't enjoy something like that either. I think no shade if
that,
you do.
You just nailed it for me, Mary, because that's exactly how I feel. Like, I don't have judgment for people that want to read it. And I don't think that that necessarily means that they want to be assaulted. But for me, that is not something I want consent.
I have a friend who did a master's in English literature, and she wrote this thesis that I found really fascinating about non-consent and dubious consent and an actual assault in like the bodice ripper early historical romance, and was like, and her thesis was that the reason it was cathartic or even sexy for many women to read stories in which someone who knows the protagonist has assaulted them or has had sex with them in a way that's less consensual.
Yeah.
Right. Like whatever on that spectrum. And the reason that women found that enjoyable was as a way to process things that happened to them, but also specifically in the lens of like, we know statistically that if you experience these kinds of things, it's likely to come at the hands of someone that you know. And so in her thesis was that the reason it felt cathartic for these stories to be like, he did this bad thing, but it was to protect you all along, is to try to kind of have this, like make sense of something that doesn't make sense in a romance and in a, like a, some kind of a removed setting. And so I know we're veering into something that probably needs a little bit of a trigger warning now. So I apologize, but I found it to be a really interesting take on the, you know, why people, readers like enjoy these things. I think there's a lot of like shame about those when people say they like to read that stuff. And so I think it was really, her take was really interesting because I was like, oh, like, of course it makes sense. Brain science. Why would we would want to explore something like that in fiction?
Yeah. I've heard a few TikTokers that I follow, book talkers that I follow talk about it being a reckoning for them. Like it was a way for them to process their trauma. And so for that reason, that is great. And I'll say the book had some fun parts. Like there were parts of that book that I was like, this is a good time. But I don't plan to read the rest of the series. But I prefer romances that are grumpy sunshine, slow burn. Like that's my marriage. And so that's what I gravitate towards. But anyway, all right. So this book comes out on July 29th. Everyone needs to go get it. What else would you like listeners to know about your book, and where can they find your book, and what formats will it be available in?
Yeah, there's audiobook and ebook. I love it's two narrators for the audiobook, which I'm really excited about. I got to choose them. I really love them. I haven't actually heard their the whole thing as an audiobook yet, but I got to listen to some samples and they're lovely. And it will also be out in paperback. So if you are, there are actually two ways to get it. I have a pre-order campaign. I think I have some of the things here. Yeah. So I have like bookmark and I have Paris's lighter as a sticker, which I will get my publicist to send you all some. And then if you are not ordering from my indie bookstore, I will send signed book plates to a couple of indies who will distribute that. And I'll have more details on like where you can get all of that soon. I'm partnering with a couple of different romance bookstores around the country. And then the way you can get like a signed paperback is to order it through Tropes and Trifles in Minneapolis, where I'm doing my book launch on the 29th. So if you are a Minneapolis local, come and see me. It'll be a party. And yeah, it'll be out in the world just next month, which is really exciting. I did want to plug one more thing. So Barnes & Noble always does this big pre-order sale, and authors have to promote pre-orders because that's how we continue our careers. So even if our books don't go in Barnes & Noble, we are asked to promote it. And no shade to Barnes & Noble. I actually love going to my local Barnes & Noble. But I'm organizing an event with another author that's a pre-order party to support indie bookstores specifically. So we're partnering with like Libro FM and Bookshop and all of these participating indies. And they're doing like discounted pre-orders for any book that's up for pre-order, including mine. And authors are donating like big prize packs if you participate. And it'll be a really fun time. So you can get my book through that, and that would actually probably be the most fun because you'll get a little discount too. So
that's awesome.
You can get it many places, but party with the party with the indie bookstores because they're more fun. So
yes, we have a really great We have a really great indie bookstore that's a romance bookstore here. It's like an hour from me, but it's in coastal Virginia. It's called Novel Grounds. So if you haven't reached out to them yet.
Oh, I should.
Fine. You should. Yeah. We did a book launch for Emma Berry, who is a Montlenk author, and her book launch, we interviewed her live in the bookstore. It's a fantastic store. We love it there. So yeah, reach out to them. Novel Grounds.
Novel Grounds. I will make a note of that. Yeah. My partner is from Virginia. Where in Virginia? Can I ask you that? Is that something you say?
I'll tell you off pod.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
I always say I'm in coastal Virginia because that's true. I am in the Hampton Roads area, like the south east side of the state. But my town specifically, I'll tell you after.
That makes sense. My partner's also from coastal Virginia specifically. So I was like listening to like you talk and I was like, that accent sounds like home. So
well, I am from Ohio, so I don't know.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think I heard a little bit of the southern twang, but it sometimes speaks in my partner's as well. That's I love
possible.
It.
That's possible. I've been in the South a while. And my husband will love the fact that you said I have a little southern twang because he is from the South and he has made it his mission to make me a southerner. I'm like, I am a Yankee through and through. I don't know what to tell you. All right. So what's next for you? You've got another book contract, but we don't have a release date yet, or we do?
So I have a lot of books coming out. I have two books out this year. One of them is We Are the Match, and then one of them is my next YA thriller, Seven for a Secret, which comes out in September. And that is also about angry women, but it is less romantic. And then next year I have at least three books out. I don't know exactly release dates on all of that. Romanticy is one that'll be out in June. And then in July, is probably when I will have the second book with Montlenk, which will be another spicy, dark romance I can say a tiny, tiny bit. And that is a contract killer and an ex-librarian have the same person they want to kill. And sparks fly when she messes up his hit. And then they have to work together to complete their mission of killing a billionaire. So it's like billionaire romance if we hate billionaires, which we do.
But you had me at librarian.
Yeah. Like, yes. Mm-hmm. And then I have the middle grade out as well next, probably August, I think. So, yeah, a lot on my plate. I'm really excited. It's been a fun, wild ride.
Yeah, that's amazing. And all this is on your website, right?
So yes, we can direct all of it is on my website.
Your website. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I will put her website down below in the description. And I'll also link to your social media because you're on Instagram and TikTok, right?
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm.
And I will link to that as well. Well, is there anything else readers should know?
Just be gay, do crime. That's what it's all about, right?
Be gay, do crime. Yes, that's what's
all about. Hopefully I don't get in trouble with my publicist for saying that, but I said it with my whole chest. So
It's fine. I am here to affirm that. So this was our season finale. So besties, we are taking a break. Thank you so much, Mary, for coming on. This has been awesome and a really good, like, intellectually stimulating discussion that has my brain just happy right now. But we're taking a break. We will be back with new episodes in September, but we are going to be at the Columbus Book Festival this summer. We're moderating two panels, one on Saturday and one on Sunday. We'll also be there passing out stickers and passing out flyers and just really interacting. We're going to try to do some spot interviews. So if you want to be on the Book Besties podcast, find us. We'll be in these really cool shirts. And we'll just interview people on the fly. Hopefully get to talk to a few other authors. Molly is still bound and determined that we're going to get Matt Dinneman, which would make me very happy because I'm on the seventh book right now of the Dungeon Crawler Carl series. And I just can't even, this is just so good. Anyway, so that's it, besties. We will see you next season for season 9 premiere in September. Follow us on all the socials. Follow our Patreon. Help us get to Columbus. We could use the cash to get there. And that's it. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us on Book Besties. Don't forget to like and subscribe. The views discussed here are those of April and Molly, not those of anyone else. Today's book was We Are the Match by our special guest, Mary E. Roach. Your book besties are Molly Biggs and April Watkins, editing by Thomas Watkins, and music is Sleep Sweetly by Prigida. Don't forget to follow the book besties on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. If you'd like to contact the book besties, please email us at bookbestiespod@gmail.com or visit our website, bookbestiespodcast.com. You can support the book besties by joining our Patreon, Book Besties Podcast. Until next time, besties, get lost in your favorite book.